Hello, everyone. I'm Art Tomasetti, and this is the Flight Test Safety Podcast. Now, we're just about a week away from the Flight Test Safety Workshop in Seattle, where I hope to get to see some of you in person. Now, hopefully, you've already registered to join us for what will be a great learning and networking event. Now, let's start this episode with two flight test history events. The first involving one of my all-time favorite aircraft, the F-104 Starfighter. Now, I want to read from the Reno Gazette, dated 20 April, 1955.
Extra, extra, read all about it!
Headline, test pilot leaps from new jet. Inukern, California, April 20th. Herman R. Fish Salmon, former racing pilot and now a top test pilot, bailed safely from one of the Air Force's hot new F-104 jet fighters over the Mojave Desert Tuesday. He was spotted on the desert after a two-hour search by military planes and brought to the Naval Ordnance Test Station here for a physical examination. A preliminary checkup indicated he was not injured. Salmon, 41, was on a routine test flight when he hit the silk. Authorities gave no hint what happened to the super-secret plane to make the bailout necessary. The craft's height at the time it was abandoned was not given, but the plane's top speed has been unofficially estimated at 1,200 miles per hour. Wreckage of the F-104, one of two prototypes now being tested by Lockheed Aircraft Corporation for the Air Force, was found several miles south of the China Lake area. A Lockheed spokesman said Salmon of Van Nuys, California, was spotted by a search plane and apparently picked up by a Navy helicopter and flown here. Salmon took off on the test flight from Palmdale, about 70 miles south of here.
Extra, extra.
Salmon was flying the second prototype Lockheed XF-104 Interceptor, conducting tests of the Vulcan gun system. On the second test, vibrations from the gun loosened the airplane's ejection hatch, located beneath the cockpit, resulting in explosive decompression. The XF-104 had a downward-firing ejection seat. Salmon was wearing a David Clark Company T1 capstan-type partial pressure suit and a K1 helmet for protection for just such an emergency. With his visor fogged over, he cut the throttle, opened the speed brakes, and began a descending turn. By the time he had reached 15,000 feet, he had been unable to find a place on the desert floor to make an emergency landing. So at 250 knots, the ejection seat fired Salmon out of the bottom of the cockpit. He had to open his parachute manually, as a seat timer did not operate, but made a safe landing. Explosive decompression from gunfire. What are the odds? Now, moving forward to 19 April 1960, Grumman Aircraft Engineering Corporation test pilot Robert K. Smith made the first flight of the prototype YA-2F-1 Intruder at the Grumman Peconic River Airport in Long Island, New York. During the flight, Smith climbed to 15,000 feet with the landing gear extended. At one point, Smith attempted to retract the gear, but a malfunction was indicated, so they remained down and locked. The first flight lasted about 1 hour. 8 Grumman YA-2F-1 Intruders were built for the test program. They were later redesignated A-6 Intruder in 1962. And, speaking of things that can happen on first flight, last month we started a conversation with Roy Martin and Mike Rabins about first flight anomalies. They shared some of their research into the myriad of things that have occurred on first flights of new aircraft. Please take the time to listen to part one if you haven't already. This month, we'll pick up that discussion, but we're going to look into common threads across these events and talk about some best practices. So, let's pick up with part two of First Flight Anomalies.
Exactly. Anyway, that kind of gives you a summary of some of the findings that we found.
Okay. So as you went through and you looked at all of those cases, I've got to imagine, and you've highlighted a few things already, that you found some commonalities. And when I first started thinking about our discussion, I just kind of assumed in my brain that the commonalities you came across were all the, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. But I'm guessing in addition to those, which you can talk about, you probably found some things that were like in the category of best practice and things that you should do, kind of what you just alluded to, Roy. So can you share a little bit about some commonalities you found across the cases you looked at?
Yeah, I'll start off, and I think the best practice, bar none, is to have the control room, the cockpit crew, test director, test conductor, have that team go through rehearsals, and you're rehearsing things with fault insertion that prepare the team to deal with the unexpected events. You may not ever see in the test campaign an actual, you know, failure of this or failure of that. But as you work the team, and this was the hallmark that came through loud and clear in our research, as you work the team through these various scenarios, they gel as a team, and it allows them to coolly and calmly deal with whatever may come up during event. So that was a good, that was a positive, and that was a best practice that we saw across all the successful teams.
I'll echo that, Durbo, because on a couple of the first flights I've personally been have been working or have worked in the past, the anomalies that we practiced were not the anomaly that occurred on the first flight. But because we did practice and we did develop a team concept, we were able to handle the issue without any real, you know, without any real stress involved, if you will. But that practice of a control room team, we cannot emphasize too much.
Absolutely. So let me ask another question. As we grow up going through test pilot school, for those of us came up that path of learning that one of the most important things we are supposed to do is, in addition to flying whatever it is we're going to go fly, is to write down what happened on those flights. As you did your research, were you able to easily find documentation written down, or was it more having to rely on people and persons to recount their stories? How easy was it to actually track down some of the data behind these stories?
Well, I'll start again. I think it was, if you've been in the industry a long time, like you and I and Roy have, you pick up anecdotes from people that you remember, and then you can go back to those people, much like we did for this Northrop Grumman event. And that was preceded by First Flights in the Antelope Valley event that SETP, SFTE, and AIAA sponsored. So going to those events over time, get it. But if you're new in this business, then it's most technical papers that are presented talk about the good things that happened, and you have to dig a little bit for the safety related lessons learned. They're there, especially SETP is really good about that, and SFTE as well. But anything in the popular press is going to be very positively spun, and you're not going to see that stuff. I think, to answer your question, that the forums that the flight test societies sponsor are the best source of information, because if you can get that firsthand recounting of what happened and how it was reacted, there's going to be so much more detail than just a summary of lessons learned that might be in a printed paper. The devil's in the details, good or bad, and hearing it from the people that were there, I think, has immense value.
Right.
I'll echo that again, because finding the material written down is difficult, which is the genesis as to why we actually did this paper and are going to follow it up with a written record, so that there will be something to go to. But a lot of it is just having heard it through the history of your career, and I remember something about, but the actual detail is buried in some test report somewhere that's in a library, and it's generally very hard to get to. So a lot of this starts with doing just what Mike did. Let's bring in the people that were involved in first flights historically, and let's understand from them what the events had occurred.
Right. And I guess that was kind of a leading question now that I think about it, because in addition to being able to pass on the lessons learned, the best practices, the what to look out for sorts of things you all came up with in the scenarios you looked at, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's equally important to tell the test teams of today and tomorrow, in addition to doing all those things, please document what you do so that the 2 decades from now team of people that wants to put together what's happened has something to go back and look to.
Yeah, absolutely. And the commercial sector does more first article, first flights than defense. But, you know, in our company, and I don't think it's that different in all of the major aerospace companies, you know, if a generation of people is about 15 years as folks work through their career, it's not uncommon to, you know, it's a once in a career event to go with a first article, first flight. So documenting is essential.
Right.
And just kind of building a little bit on what he just said in the end, if you are a young engineer or a test pilot or flight test engineer, and you've been assigned to a first flight, first article team, that's almost like the pinnacle of your career. And that's meant to be enjoyed, because you've now grown up to be a part of the Super Bowl, if you will, of flight test when you get to that level when you're trusted with being assigned to a first article, first flight. And so if that does happen, enjoy the moment.
Right. Yeah. And on that, I think I'm just a little junior than the both of you, but not by much. But I think all of us in our career span, you know, realize that there was this time back in the 50s and 60s where there were a lot of these first flight things happening, thinking a lot in the military domain, but even on the commercial side as well. And then there was kind of this sort of dip and not as many things happening. I know when I graduated test pilot school, I was ecstatic to be assigned to something that had an X in front of it because I knew those didn't happen very much anymore.
Yep.
But now we're in an age, in a time where there's a lot of things, space things and electric things and fixed wing and rotary wing and a whole bunch of stuff that's happening where there's, I think, a whole lot of first flights that are happening now and are going to continue to happen in the near term. So I think everything you're talking about is so, so relevant. And I think we're at another kind of inflection point in the world of aviation, right, where we're seeing a lot of this stuff happening.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so we've got just a few minutes left here. And what I do with everybody who's a guest on the podcast is you all have a lot of experience individually and then collectively between you. Share some words of wisdom, things you said, hey, you know, with the listeners for our podcast, if they had a chance to get a pearl of wisdom from Roy Martin or Mike Ravens, what would that be?
Well, I think one thing you kind of want to make sure is you not only have your primary plan for your first flight, but think through the backup plans. Like, you know, things like, okay, the gear didn't come up, but the gear came down and it's down and locked. Have we got a pre-approved alternate card where we can go ahead and continue to do some testing with the gear down and continue to expand the envelope there? Are you ready for that telemetry failure? Are you ready for the comm failure? Do you have those backup plans? So think through that what if and just keep going over those scenarios until you feel comfortable. Yeah, we know what we're going to happen if this occurs or if that occurs. I know under the UAVs, I used to worry a lot about all the learning the 400 things that could go wrong and what am I going to do? And I got to thinking, you know, this vehicle, I'm either going to put it in an orbit or we're going to RTB or we're going to destroy it. So once you get down to the final, okay, these are the things we're going to do. As far as a test pilot, you boil it down to what are my actions going to be? I don't care what happens. I don't care if it's a, you know, got a problem with the fuel system, electrical system. What are going to be my overview actions? And so, because I'm going to be flying the plane and going to keep flying the plane, but what are going to be those big actions that I'm going to do? I'm going to orbit, I'm going to RTB, what are we going to do? Okay. So that's, think that through. That's kind of my pass on, I guess you'd say. Right?
Yeah, Turbo, what I would say is our model-based system engineering, model-based T&E, model-based is getting better and better and better. Our SILs, our amazing system integration labs, hardware in the loop labs, Ironbirds, we really have a tremendous capability to do very thorough testing on the ground. But the first time you go fly and then subsequent flights, that's the only time everything is really operating together in the air. And we've talked about the value of the rehearsals and the value of preparation, but that's the really people need to really think about all of the interrelated, interdependent systems and all the things like that XB70, you know, landing gear thing. It's, you know, that's not something you could test on the ground very well. And so that the teams really need to think through, you know, do those, briefing room exercises, if you will, where they think through what are we going to do if this happens, that happens, because you can't test everything on the ground and you got to be ready for whatever happens in the air.
Right. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedules to join me on the podcast. I very much appreciate it and look forward to catching up with you in person at a future date.
Thank you, Turbo. Thank you for allowing us to pass on what we've learned. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Turbo.
All right, let me stop the recorder.
Recording stopped.
All right. I think that was great. I got more than enough for one episode. And like I said, usually it's something like this. I knew it was going to be a gold mine, so it'll probably be a two-parter. And I want, again, a personal thanks for me. You know, I do what I do for this podcast, but the only reason it's really successful is because of the people I get to talk to. So sharing your story, sharing your knowledge, sharing your experience, that's what makes this podcast work. I do the mechanics of it, and that's it. So thanks so much.
I want you to know that because of your podcast, in my case, I actually was able to learn something because you had a guy on, I think it was a B1 gentleman. Mm-hmm. And so then I went to him to kind of get some of the information related to the B1. In your question related to, did you find documentation? I do remember from after the B1 first flight, they came over and talked to test pilot school, which I was impressed with. I was a student at test pilot school, and here's these guys that just completed this flight this morning, and they're over here talking to us this afternoon at the auditorium. But the guy made a comment, the pilot made a comment, you know, things were occurring. We couldn't figure it out. And we found out later that essential bus number one, electrical bus, had failed. But the telelight, the caution light that would have told us that electrical bus one failed, was actually wired to electrical bus one. So when the bus failed, the light didn't come on. And I said, can you document that for sure? And he said, you know, I've never heard that story. I said, well, I hope it's not a figment of my imagination, right. But I know it's not. But I could never get the actual test report to verify that. So I didn't feel comfortable with presenting that. So there was actual other information out there that, because we can't really nail it down, we're a little unsure as to whether we really ought to be putting it out. You know?
Yeah, but it does. That's kind of why I asked that question about the documentation, because I will tell you, just, you know, my limited experience with JSF is, you know, I know that there's a lot of stuff out there about X-35. I probably own a lot of it myself because the program office has called me occasionally for pictures and stuff. Mm-hmm. But when you try and go find information on that other airplane, the X-32, it's, you know, because it didn't win, it's like no one decided to preserve stuff. And it has a lot of stories to tell as well. Exactly. And it's unfortunate that we don't, you know, we don't do as good a job sometimes of documenting this stuff as we should. And that's, you know, kind of the hope I have for all these folks in the eVTOL world and the space world, especially, is, hey, you're all running really fast. Everybody's trying to get to market and all those things. Got it. But please write down what you're doing, because it will matter to somebody down the road.
I think. Amen. Yeah, I agree. Anyway, all good, Turbo. Thank you for doing this.
Great. Thank you again, gentlemen. You enjoy the rest of your week.
So, a lot of great information, lessons learned, and takeaways in this discussion with Roy Martin and Mike Ravens. And given how much groundbreaking work, innovation, and firsts are happening in aerospace today, I think a relevant and timely topic. Well, that'll wrap us up for April. Until next time, be safe, be smart, and be ready.
The Flight Test Safety Podcast is sponsored by Time to Climb Training and Consulting. Motivate your team to succeed, accelerate towards your goals, and elevate to a higher level of performance. On the web at www.time2climb.com.